you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we were looking at rivers, at canals, and at coastal transport in the ancient and medieval period. And today we're going to focus on the Tudors and the Stuarts as we move forward, reminding ourselves that the point we made last time, that water transport tends to be underrated, is also true for this period. And therefore, if we want to try and understand the experience of those who travelled in the Tudor and Stuart period, we have to remember that many did so by water, whether for freight or as passengers, and that we need to think about that. And of course, the importance of rivers, as with the earlier periods, focused attentions on the bridges and ferries that existed. I mean, rivers, just like roads, were not part of a separate system, although that element was part of it. They were part of an interacting multiplicity of systems, local, regional and national, and we use the term systems, but obviously, and the point we were making last time, is you have to allow for all of the constraints and problems posed particularly by the environment, things like flooding and drought and freezing, but also by human action, things like building weirs across rivers, all of which made the operation of them less good. So, for example, if you're looking at the bridges of the period, which reflected the interaction of river and land transport, there was still the seven-arched medieval stone bridge over the Tyne at Newcastle. There were major bridges at places like Barnstaple and Biddeford, Exeter and Gloucester, Oxford and York. London Bridge remained the lowest crossing point on the Thames, and there was no road crossing of the Tamar into Cornwall downriver of Gunnislake. That continued, in fact, until 1961, when the Tamar Bridge was opened. Obviously, there was a rail crossing prior to that, but not a road one. And that long encouraged a dependence on coastal shipping in order to travel to Cornwall. Bridges themselves continued to be under pressure from decay, the weather and storms. Now, William Shakespeare was one of the Stratford-upon-Avon citizens who subscribed to the cost of promoting an Act of Parliament for road repairs. But if you look at his plays, he not only commented on the state of the roads, but also the state of rivers, with the expectation that his listeners would be very familiar with the experience of being on the water, which, of course, was absolutely true with Londoners. Many of them might well be listening to his plays being produced in Southwark on the south bank of the River Thames, having crossed over from the north bank, classically, in a boat. And, for example, the experience of being in the water is discussed in Two Gentlemen of Verona, in which Julia compares true love to a stream flowing naturally. The current that with gentle murmur glides, thou knowest being stopped, impatiently doth rage. And the assumption would be that, you know, listeners would understand that in a way that today they just simply wouldn't. Many settlements and country houses of the Tudor period and the Stuart period, for example, Anthony House in Cornwall or Hampton Court on the Thames, were best reached by water. And the grand London houses on the Thames along the Strand had water gates through which visitors and goods moved. The Tower of London further east was frequently approached from the Thames, most famously by Traitor's Gate. And more generally, water, both the sea and inland waterways, had far more of an impact on people's lives than is the case today. Many towns that now lack quays and wharfs were then ports. Although they didn't link most of the country to London, except by means also of coastal transport, so, you know, the Humber, for example, you would then have to sail down the North Sea to get into the Thames area, rivers combined to form trading systems that covered much of the country on a pattern that had existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. So in the West Midlands, for example, the Severn was navigable as far as Bewdley near Kidderminster. The Stratford-Avon was navigable almost to Warwick, and the Lug to Leinster. All of these waterways combined to enhance the importance of the Severn system, and thus of the nearby major seaport Bristol. Nearby, but not incidentally, tributaries of the Severn, the Wye was navigable up to Hereford, and the Parret, both those rivers extended the significance of the riverborne network floating into the Bristol Channel. More generally, inland ports across the country, across England, included Bridgewater on the Parret, Gloucester, Langport, Lincoln, Norwich, Stratford, Tewkesbury and York. In contrast, in this period, Scotland and separately Wales were far worse served by inland waterways than lowland England, although both were very well served by coastal trade. A corollary to the role of rivers, of course, was provided by a high water table across much of lowland England, and therefore the difficulties of the wet, as it were, for road transport. And that, of course, could encourage people to go by river. A lot compared to today, a larger number of ports handled foreign trade than was to be the case from the 19th century on, when the greater size of merchantmen led to the concentration of long-distance trade on fewer harbours that had the necessary draft as well as facilities for handling large ships. Shakespeare, of course, frequently presented or mentioned storms and shipwrecks, as in The Tempest, The Merchant of Venice, Twelfth Night, A Winter's Tale, Pericles, The Comedy of Errors, Measure for Measure, and Richard III. In Othello, which of course was not set in England, it was set in Cyprus, but nevertheless, again, it reflects the way in which listeners would understand references to sea travel. Montano asks, "What ribs of oak, when mountainous and when mountains, by which he meant mountainous seas, melt on them, can hold the mortise?" In other words, you know, how will the ships be able to cope with these storms without cracking? In Richard III, shortly before being drowned in a butt of wine in the Tower of London, George Duke of Clarence dreams of drowning in the sea, seeing, quote, a thousand men that fishes gnawed upon. At Dunster Castle in Somerset, close to the Bristol Channel, there is an allegorical painting by the London-based painter Hans Eworth, dated 1550, of Sir John Luttrell, the contemporary owner, depicting him emerging half-naked from a storm-tossed sea, while in the background sailors abandoned a sinking ship. Commentators have suggested that this actually refers to Luttrell's career as a military commander. But even so, the example and image are still striking, and it's likely that, just as likely, that it refers to a real shipwreck. Certainly, nearby, the reefs on the island of Lundy in the Bristol Channel claimed many ships, and the construction there of a major lighthouse, which was only completed in 1820, was long overdue. The route itself down the Bristol Channel was important to the trade with Ireland, which developed not least because of a major increase in English settlement in the Tudor period, one that encouraged imports into Ireland from Bristol, from Chester, and from other ports. The improvement of navigation by means of lighthouses was linked to the 1514 foundation of Trinity House and 1566 powers for it to build lighthouses. Now, in the Tudor period, there was scant improvement to the transport system as a whole. Instead, the enormous wealth produced by the despoliation of the monasteries, by economic growth and by parliamentary taxation, all of which brought enormous wealth to the Tudor monarchy, was largely spent on foreign policy in the sense of wars with France, Scotland and Spain. As a result of which, And other factors as well. There is no real major transport system constructed. And I think it's fair to say that this is true for both rivers and roads. Rivers were certainly seen as crucial, but there was little change to the situation. And Harry Hotspur's fictional proposal of a new channel for the Trent in Shakespeare's play Henry IV, Part One, which came out in 1597, was treated in the play as fantastical. Instead, of sense of stability was presented in his Survey of London of 1598 by John Stowe, who proudly compared London to the prospects offered elsewhere by other rivers. Quote, "This realm," by which he means England and Wales, "has only three principal rivers on which a royal city may be situated: Trent in the north, Severn in the southwest, and Thames in the southeast. Of which the Thames, both of the straight course in length, reaches furthest into the belly of the land, and for the breadth and stillness of the water, is most navigable up and down the stream, by reason whereof London, standing almost in the middle of that course, is more commodiously served with provision of necessaries than any town standing upon the other two rivers can be, and doth also more easily communicate to the rest of the realm commodities of her own production and trade." Actually, the Severn and even more the Trent, in many respects, were more impressive as rivers, but the point about the Thames, of course, is that London was the capital, and that therefore that helped to make its environment and its geographical setting more important. On a long-standing pattern, which we mentioned last week, water transport was hindered by the need to use water power for manufacturing, as reflected in mills and weirs. So in other words, water power was the major source. Rivers were also used for transport. There was a clash. As a result, there was long-standing disputes on many rivers. The Earl of Devon's weir over the Exe, downstream of Exeter, was a major point of disagreement from the 13th to the 16th centuries, because it stopped ships from reaching Exeter and benefited the rival port of Topsham. The river channel was reopened after the execution in 1538 of Henry, 1st Marquess of Exeter, who had fallen foul of his former friend Henry VIII, and that rather dealt with the Courtney interest. But the river channel had become silted up and was circumvented in 1564-7 by the construction of a channel, the Exeter Ship Canal, which remains in use to the present, albeit no longer for freight. And it's interesting. I mean, I walk along it frequently. It's still an impressive testimony to what the Tudors could do. One wonders, quite frankly, how many of our infrastructural projects will last that long. The Trent was a similar cause of controversy, with Newark's mills a major issue and the mill owners opposed to plans, for example, in about 1540, to divert the river. There was particular controversy over a mill weir over the Trent near Shelford Priory, which, as a result of the despoliation of the monasteries, had been acquired by the Stanhope family and therefore was a source of profit to them. They clashed over the weir with another powerful local landowner, Gilbert Earl of Shrewsbury. And in the event, in order to deal with the problem, a long diversion channel was dug in 1593 to bypass the mill. So in other words, very local canals to bypass a weir on the river. And the importance of the cloth industry encouraged the authorization of weirs for mills, as in an act for the Wye in 1555. And this clashed with other legislation, such as the establishment of a commission of sewers under the Statute of Sewers of 1531, which the commission was established in 1535 to pull down all weirs and mills obstructing river navigation. Now, you will not be surprised to hear the clashes between branches or purposes of government were just as frequent in the 16th century as today. There were also improvements in some harbours. At Dover, Henry VII gave money to encourage the building of a new harbour. And You know, Henry VIII began the construction of a long stone mole or breakwater at the port of Dover in order to provide product protection. However, cost as well as the difficulty of the task led to the abandonment of the unfinished plan at the end of the reign. And again, same sort of thing that one could see today. For all harbours, sea and river, the rotting impact of water on wooden quays and the pressure of tides on stone structures was a major cause of expenditure. More generally, I think, you know, other than Dover, which was important in terms of obviously the links to the continent, Kent displayed both the possibility and the problems of water transport. I mean, water transport was important because the difficulty of transportation across the terrain of the Weald meant that people preferred to ship goods from ports such as Sandwich to London. And Kent was a major source of, as indeed was Sussex, of grain for London. And that was obviously helpful in dealing with agitation in London, but correspondingly just moved social turmoil elsewhere. So created grain shortages in the areas from which the grain was shipped. Another major good that was moved was coal. Coal was shipped from Newcastle on the Tyne in increasing quantities to London, 15,000 tons annually in the 15th century, 400,000 tons by 1625, a trade that was the most important form of coastal transport. You know, it's worth bearing in mind that you couldn't think of economic change unless you were able to consider the extent to which water in the 16th century is a key provisor, you know, key basis for it. Now, we're now going to move on to the 17th century, but I wonder, Graham, before moving on to the 17th century, whether there's anything you wanted to raise yourself.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. I'm very interested in what you say about the Exeter Ship Canal as a very early example of the use of government in creating a canal. Was that followed by many other examples, or should that just be seen as an isolated incident
Well,
which
it's a largely isolated incident for the 16th century. There wasn't much building of canals. And in one respect, you could argue that the Exeter Ship Canal was really an aspect of, if you like, not so much a substitute for the river system, though that is what it was, but it's an extension of the sea navigation, which I think is more pertinent one. What you haven't got is, as you were to get in the 18th century, significant inland canal systems. As yet, those are not being built.
And is there a relationship between state interest and military considerations? So, you know, if you're dealing with rivers or estuaries that flow into the sea, that you know, that's got a military, potentially a military angle in a way in which further inland it's less likely to, or is that did the state not make that connection?
Well, the major thing to do with the coast the state invested in the 16th century was in fortifications. Henry VIII built a series of fortifications along the south coast, new style forts mounting cannon, in many senses in response to the agreement of 1538 between Francis I of France and the Emperor Charles V, and the idea that there might be a joint Catholic action against England. And under Elizabeth I, again, the major fortification project was coastal, namely the fortification of Berwick, although there was also significant work, for example, at Tilbury. So that was more significant. There was not really an idea that you were going to have. There was no equivalent to, for example, the military canal that gets put in near Rye during the Napoleonic Wars. There is that contrast, I suppose, that but the hope was that a combination of warships, fortresses, fortified ports, and trained bands, local militia, would be able to protect England. I mean, there is an interesting question as to what would have happened if the Armada had landed in 1588, or indeed there'd been an invasion in 1538, 50 years earlier. That wasn't a debate held in terms of whether they should or shouldn't improve communication.
Oh, that's interesting to know. Well, let's proceed onto the 17th century.
Okay, yeah, 17th century then. Well, in many senses, unsurprisingly so, a lot about the 17th century was similar. I mean, I think it's worth bearing in mind that an enormous amount of resources were consumed for much of the 17th century as a result of war. The unsuccessful wars of the 1620s against France and Spain, the unsuccessful war at the end of the 1630s, beginning of the 1640s, the Bishops' Wars between England and Scotland, the civil wars more generally of the 1640s and early 1650s, and then war with Spain in the 1650s. All of those consumed a lot of resource, and it's not really surprising that there was not any significant change to the communication system in the country. I think it's more in the second half of the 17th century that one's looking for change. For example, if you're looking at coastal transport, it seems to have been increasing and with significant economic consequences. So the first shipload of Cheshire cheese reached London in 1650, London, of course, the largest market in the country. By 1664, more than 14 cheese ships were sailing from the northwest, and by the 1680s, over 50. Cheese, of course, was the easiest way to consume milk in that period. This was an aspect of the transition of Cheshire itself from what it had been hitherto, which was largely inward-looking, partly subsistence economy, to one instead integrated into that of the country as a whole. And coastal trading was risky, you know, ships could be sunk, but could also be rewarding. Cheese is indicative because it's a food not dependent on immediate consumption and which didn't rot rapidly. It also came to London from Somerset by sea via Bristol, which in turn was supplied from South Wales with butter and milk. And return cargoes from London helped to transform the regional economy in the northwest and encourage shipbuilding. So economic integration being of quite distant areas being encouraged by sea rather than the shorter distance of overland. Coastal transport indeed aided development in many distant areas from the late 17th century, for example, with grain exports from Cardiganshire, again to London. The possibilities for coastal transport were enhanced by the number of ports able to take part in trade. Indeed, there was a considerable overlap with those ports operating as hubs for broader regional and local networks. So if you part in foreign trade, let's say Bristol or Southampton, you would then be a hub in which more local ports would ship stuff to you, and you would be the place where cargoes were organised into deeper draft vessels. So, for example, Bristol's twice yearly fairs were important to a network defined by coastal and river trade. The potential of ports, in turn, was lessened by them silting up. And there's no obviously equivalent to the steam dredgers that developed in the 19th century. And silting up hit Chester on the Dee to the benefit of Liverpool on the Mersey, where the depth of water was good for large vessels, even if the tide was out, which was not the case at Chester. Silting also hit Barnstaple as the Tor was silting up to the benefit of Biddeford, which was closer to the estuary. Now, if you're looking at a source from the period, Daniel Defoe, in his A Journal of the Plague Year, which came out in 1722, it's written about the plague of 1665. But what he's talking about is both 1665 and also what would seem viable to an audience of 1722. Defoe commented on the coastal trade for grain and coal. The first of these was particularly carried on by small vessels from the port of Hull and other places on the Humber, by which great quantities of corn, he means wheat, were brought in from Yorkshire and Lincolnshire. The other part of this corn trade was from Lynn, that's King's Lynn, in Norfolk, from Wells and Burnham, also in Norfolk, and from Yarmouth, that's Great Yarmouth, all in the same county. And the third branch was from the River Medway, and from Milton, Feversham, Margate and Sandwich, and all the other little places and ports around the coast of Kent and Essex. There was also a very good trade from the coast of Suffolk with corn, butter and cheese. So in other words, an enormous supply of food to London, essentially by water. Now, 17th century British developments in river improvement canals were relatively modest. There's no equivalent to the Canal du Midi, which is put in under Louis XIV in France. So if you're looking at Britain, the stretch of the Thames below Oxford became navigable again for barges in 1635, following the construction of some locks. The 15.5 mile River Wey navigation between the Thames and Guildford in 1653, which was the first major river navigation involving extensive new cutoffs, was predicated on the booming and profitable trade in grain and timber from West Surrey to London. But such improvement was uncommon in this period. In 1623, John Taylor, a pamphleteer who visited Salisbury, pressed for an improvement in the navigation of the Hampshire Avon, but nothing happened. Soon after, in 1626, Henry Briggs, a prominent mathematician interested in economic development, made a survey of the rivers Avon and Thames and proposed a canal to link them. But the plan was not pursued, and the same was true of plans to this end after the Civil War, which was a period in which Parliament considered 11 bills for river improvement in 1662-5. You know, some of them were passed, but that didn't mean anything really particularly happened. And I would argue that it's not really until the situation is transformed with the Glorious Revolution in 1688-89, in which you get, as a result of which, a regularisation of Parliament, a stabilisation of public finances, and that those provide much more of a determination to use parliamentary means to improve the country. So there were a series of improvements to river navigation. The Eyre and Calder navigation to Leeds and Halifax in 1699-1700 proves a very important step, easing links to Wakefield and to Hull, and thus the movement of coal and woollen goods. Parliament held hearings over the merits of the navigation scheme in 1698. Petitions were printed and reasons published on both sides. And I think it's fair to say that the legislative process was changing at the same time that there was a greater willingness to consider quite significant investment. So Britain's first dry dock was constructed on the Thames in the 1690s. And I think this is important because the ethos, you could call it, after Francis Bacon, Baconian notions of improvement, you could refer to it as political economy, a term used in the late 17th century. But in any rate, there was the idea of state action. And the most significant one, as far as trade was concerned, was the Navigation Acts, which were intended to help national shipping and trade, and in particular, again, at the expense of the Dutch. This was a form of mercantilism. As yet, mercantilism had not meant a significant enhancement of the national infrastructure. But I think it's fair to say that people were moving in that direction. And another aspect of the move in that direction was the accumulation of information. Now, I referred when we were talking about roads to more atlases, road atlases being published in that period, such as Ogilby's Britannia of 1675. But there was also a comparable engagement with the charting of the coast. And if you don't chart the coast, coastal transport is always vulnerable, I think it's fair to say. In 1681, Charles II appointed a naval officer, Captain Greenville Collins, to, quote, make a survey of the sea coasts of the kingdom by measuring all the sea coasts with a chain and taking all the bearings of all the headlines with their exact latitudes. This survey, which took 7 years, had many limitations due to the fact it was actually accomplished possibly too quickly, the limited manpower available and the lack of an available comprehensive land survey of the coastline as the basis for a marine survey. I think listeners might like to think about this. It's quite difficult to map a coastline unless you have already a reliable map of what the land side of the coast looks like. And this is to do with, as it were, placing the positions you're mapping. But the results published in 1693 in Great Britain's Coasting Pilot were frequently reprinted and are significant. Now, what I want to close with is two quotes from the beginning of the of the 18th century, which, as it were, illustrates these two different sides of where one's been left by from the late 17th. And the first one is Jonathan Wilson, who's a Cumbrian malt dealer. And he wrote in 1726, I set forward towards Cork, in other words, from Cumbria, Cork in Ireland, of course, but I met with contrary wind and was driven into Wales, and so after 4 days came home again, and stayed about a week at home, and so set sail again, and met with contrary winds again, and was driven upon the coasts of Ireland near the mountains of Newry, that's in Ulster, but after 6 days at sea got safe and well to Dublin. So that was, shall we say, an unpredictable journey. On the other hand, The Champion, a leading opposition newspaper, in its article on the a news item in the 14th of August, 1740, so this is looking more towards an aspiration for change, said, I have heard some talk of a project to join the Avon in Somersetshire. Remember, listeners need to remember there's more than one Avon in Britain, to the Thames and the Severn with the Trent, as opening a way to circulate a share of commerce and the advantages that attend it from one extreme of the kingdom to the other. So in other words, what one has is the realities of a harsh environment affecting the transport systems available, but on the other hand, a growing interest in the 17th century, particularly at the time of the interregnum in the 1650s, and then again more particularly with and after the Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 1689, for change and the state playing, or public approval, public legislation, playing a role in that direction. Graham, I wonder if we could pause there.
Yes, we could. And a thought for me, and it's motivated slightly from knowledge about the part of the world I come from in the Fens, and that is the 17th century land improvements or attempted land improvements, particularly draining fenland, swampland, and so on. The rivers which flooded widely and had large floodplains were often very difficult for navigation. Is there a connection between some of the companies with shareholders that were created to invest in improving the land and taking similar measures to improve river navigation with proper embankment and even sluices created to try and regulate the flow of water? Are there many examples of that in the 17th century, or does that come later?
Oh, no, there is improvement of that type. And as you say, the most obvious example, not least with the Russells, the Dukes of Bedford, being key players, is in the Fenland. But there are other areas because wet lowlands are much more common, requiring drainage, are much more common in that period than they were to be by, shall we say, 1900. And as you correctly say, good big drainage ditches, such as the ones put in the Fenland, can be also used for internal transport. You're absolutely right. I mean, I made reference to Francis Bacon and the idea of Baconian interest in change, and that's the notion that in the early 17th century, there were one or two thinkers, Bacon became Lord Chancellor, there were one or two thinkers who advocate state change. And there's been some books on this. Lord Treasurer Cranfield under James I was interested in this. And it looks towards the mid-17th century. And there's a book by a chap called Charles Webster called The Great Instauration about, again, the use of the state to try and organise national resource for improvement. And that then feeds into what's known as political economy, which is and also separately mercantilism, which are two terms used, political economy more of the contemporary term, to describe these sort of attitudes in the late 17th century. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the idea of government trying to enhance the economy was scarcely new. I mean, you may recall that last week I was referring to legislation passed in the medieval period to try and regulate and improve transport on rivers, and the same thing when we were talking about roads. But I think it's fair to say that more energy was put into this in the 17th century, partly with reference, it might be argued, to a kind of Protestant notion of the improvability of society and an absence of fatalism. One has to be careful here because not all Catholics were fatalists, and not all Protestants were dedicated to being a kind of Puritan grad grinds. But that does seem to have been an important element, and it certainly is to contribute, in particular in the early 18th century, to a major effort to improve rivers, which is a prelude to the canal age of the 18th century, and which we'll be talking about next week.
Well, we will look forward to talking about that next week. But for now, Professor Jeremy Black, for talking to us about the development of waterways in Britain in the 16th and 17th centuries, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.